Welcome to Straight Up, brought to you by Peak Prosperity, which values context, curiosity, and learning that leads to action. Reading from his latest works and expanding on current events in the economy, energy, and environment, it is my pleasure to introduce your host, Dr. Chris Martinson.
Welcome, everyone, to this edition of Straight Up. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and today we're going to be talking about getting real about green energy. And this is a post that went up on Friday, October 4th, 2019. And it's an honest analysis of what green energy can and really cannot promise at this point. Look, I want to be optimistic about the future. I really do. But there's virtually no chance of the world transitioning gently to an alternative energy-powered future. And so I'm writing this because, and talking about this because, I'm asked a lot about where I stand on wind, solar, Teslas, all sorts of alternative energy sources and electrification projects. And my answer is, well, I love them, but, and there's a but here, they're incapable of enabling our society to move smoothly over to powering itself by some other means. In other words, they're not going to save us if by saving us, we mean carrying on exactly as we have been, just by other means. Now, some people are convinced otherwise. And if we can just fight off the evil oil companies, they think, or get our act together, elect the right people, install a national alternative energy system, infrastructure, hey, we're just going to be just fine. Meaning, we'll be able to continue to live as we do today, but powered by fully clean and renewable energy. Well, it's just not going to happen, at least not without a lot of painful disruption and a lot of sacrifice. And the top three reasons why it's just not going to happen are: one, math; two, human behavior; three, time, scale, and cost. So I'm going to walk through the detail next, and I'm doing so really to debunk the magical thinking behind the current green revolution, because I fear it offers a false promise. I fear that people will latch onto it and think because we can do it, that we will do it. And I have to argue here that maybe we can't even do it, even if we really wanted to. All right. Now, again, I'm a huge fan of renewable energy. I'm recording this from my home studio. I have solar on the roof. I cook with sun ovens. Just had a nice gathering of people here. And I cooked a nice dish in a sun oven. I use renewable energy as much as I can. And I'm 100% in favor of weaning the world off of its toxic addiction to fossil fuels. But we have to be eyes wide open about our future prospects here. Deluding ourselves with feel-good but unrealistic expectations about green energy will result in the same sorts of poor decisions, malinvestment, and crushed dreams as the fossil fuel-based system has delivered us already. As we constantly repeat here at Peak Prosperity, energy is everything. Without as much energy available, the future is going to be exceptionally difficult compared to the present, which is why I actually call the time we're living in right now the good old days. Yeah, you know what? These are the good old days. This is as easy as things will ever be again. And now, right now, is the time to prepare yourself for what's coming. To acquire the skills, the land, and make the financial, physical, and especially the emotional adjustments in your lifestyle that will boost your resilience for a future of less and of more expensive energy. So math. Let's start with math. Here's the math. I love the math. Makes everything clear. Suppose that we agree that the goal here is to entirely replace fossil fuels by 2050, right? I've seen a bunch of plans out there. Some of the climate plans call for that. There's other plans for other reasons that call for that, but that's a starting point, okay? Look, we're going to have to do it at some point, because coal, oil, and natural gas are all depleting finite resources. So, hey, they run out at some point. So let's just start with 2050 as our starting point. If you want to make that number happen sooner, or you want to make it happen later, just dial the math accordingly, because it's pretty simple math, right? If you were told there would be no math on this podcast, You are mistaken, but it's very simple math. It's just adding and multiplying and stuff like that, okay? And we start with this by coming to some sort of an agreement. And first thing we have to come to agreement on is how we're going to talk about the three main fossil fuels, coal, oil, natural gas. And we're going to convert those here into a common unit. And we're going to call that the millions of tons of oil equivalent, okay? So one MTOE is 1 million tons of oil equivalent. So 1 million tons of oil equals one MTOE. I'm going to call that MTOE going forward. All right. So 1 million tons of oil is an MTOE. But there's also an amount of coal that if you burned it, it has or would liberate the same energy as one MTOE. Ditto for natural gas, right? If you took a certain amount of natural gas and you burned it, you get the same energy as you would from 1 million tons of oil or an MTOE. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to add up all the fossil fuels burned in a given year, and we can express them as a single number in many, many thousands of MTOEs, right? So we're expressing everything in millions of tons of oil equivalent. Now, Roger Pilkey, he's just run the math for us in a very recent article in Forbes. Quote, in 2018, the world consumed 11,743 MTOEs in the form of coal, natural gas, and petroleum. The combustion of these fossil fuels resulted in 33.7 billion tons of carbon dioxide emissions. In order for those emissions to reach net zero, because that's the term we're hearing a lot, net zero, we'll get to that in a second, we will have to replace about 12,000 MTOEs of energy consumption expected for 2019, end quote. All right, that's a good start. I'm going to be quoting this particular article a number of times as we go through this. So in 2019, the world is going to burn about 12,000 MTOEs of fossil fuels. Great. So if we want to get to net zero, meaning that we're putting some carbon in the atmosphere, but we're taking other carbon out, net them, you get to zero. You have to find a way to get the same amount of energy as you get from 12,000 MTOEs of fossil fuels, and you're going to have to have that by some other means. Okay, so that's our starting point. Whatever future alternative energy systems get installed are going to have to replace, in 2019, around 12,000 MTOEs. Okay, now I just got to point something out here. 12,000 MTOEs. That's a truly massive amount of energy. It's an astonishing amount. Okay, to help visualize this, we're not going to use the Olympic swimming pool because people always use that. And I, like, what? How? Who can visualize what's 100,000 or a million Olympic-sized swimming pools look like? I don't even know. So we're going to do something different. We're going to use a gigantic oil-bearing cargo ship. I've got a picture of one here in the article at Peak Prosperity. It's of an ultra-large crude carrier. This case, it's the Oceania. This ship can hold a bit more than 3 million barrels of oil at a time. All right, it's just an enormous ship. It's just massive. You'd need 2.4 of those massive ships to hold one MTOE. Okay, so 2.4 of these ships will hold 1 million tons of oil, which means that we'd need a fleet of approximately 30,000 of these tankers to hold 12,000 MTOEs. That's just 12,000 times 2.4. You get about 30,000, all right? By the way, there are only currently 4 ships in the entire world of this size, but we need 30,000 of them to hold this 12,000 MTOEs. Because these are truly gigantic ships, they're 1,246 feet in length, at least this one is, the Oceania. If we had 12,000 of them, and each of them was 1,246 feet in length, that means that our fleet of 30,000 of these ships would stretch over 7,000 miles if we parked them stern to nose in a line. So are you getting a sense yet for how mind-bogglingly large the world's annual fossil energy consumption is? It's absolutely astonishing. So what would it take, though? Let's say, okay, here's the goal, though. Alternative energy future. We're going to have this green revolution. Here's what we're going to do, Chris. We're going to just have to replace those 12,000 MTOEs, those 30,000 tankers of yearly consumption of fossil fuels. We're going to have to replace that with something else. We'll call those the alternative fuels. So what would it mean to do that by 2050? What's the math here? Well, Pilkey answers that for us again in the article to continue, quote, another useful number to know is that there are 11,051 days left until January 1st, 2050. To achieve net zero carbon dioxide emissions globally by 2050 thus requires the deployment of a bit more than one MTO of carbon-free energy consumption every day, starting tomorrow and continuing for the next 30-plus years. Achieving net zero also requires the corresponding equivalent decommissioning of more than one MTO of energy consumption from fossil fuels every single day. So that's, end quote. So that's what's required. We got about 12,000 MTOs. We got about 11,000 days. That means we need to retire a bit more than one MTO per day, every day, including Sunday, including the day after the Super Bowl, including New Year's Eve and New Year's Day and Christmas and every other date you can think of. That's what we have to do. Yikes, right? I mean, more than one MTO of alternative energy systems would have to be installed every single day between now and 2050. But again, that's only half the story because we also have to decommission and retire an equivalent one MTO amount of still functioning fossil fuel property, plant, and equipment. Now, do you have any idea how much money and embedded capital is contained in all the world's current energy infrastructure? That's including your car and your home, right? Those are built around fossil fuel use. So somehow we'd have to retire those or replace those, including all your cars and, maybe your oil furnace in your house or your natural gas water heater or whatever you got, right? All that stuff would have to be replaced. Every bit of it. Somehow here, the world would have to replace the equivalent of the energy contained within 2.4 ultra massive crude ships every single day for 11,000 days straight without missing a single day. A 7,000 mile long cargo train of ultra massive ships retired at the rate of 2.4 per day for the next 30 years. Now, what would that take? Again, Pilkey runs some of the math here for us. Quote, so the math here is simple. To achieve net zero carbon dioxide emissions by 2050, the world would need to deploy three brand new nuclear plants worth of carbon-free energy every 2 days, starting tomorrow, of course, continuing to 2050. At the same time, a nuclear plant's worth of fossil fuels would need to be decommissioned every day, starting tomorrow and continuing to 2050. I've found that some people don't like the use of nuclear power plant as a measuring stick, so we can substitute wind energy as a measuring stick. Net zero carbon dioxide by 2050 would require the deployment of approximately 1,500 massive wind turbines. These are 2.5 megawatts or larger. Over 300 square miles, occupying 300 square miles every day. Every day, starting tomorrow and continuing to 2050, end quote. So, to dismantle that 7,000 mile long conga line of ultra massive crude carriers, we'd have to build and commission three new nuclear plants every 2 days or install 1,500 very large wind towers across 300 square miles every day. Hey, peeps, that's just not going to happen. Even if the world got completely serious about doing this, it remains an exceedingly improbable task. That's being kind, too. When something strays this far over the line of improbability, come on, it's impossible. Let's just call it an impossibility. Oh, and I started writing this article on a Tuesday and it got posted on a Friday, which means we're kind of already behind by nine nuclear plants. You know, we're going to have to hurry to catch those up too here in this story. But maybe you're still holding out hope, right? You listen to all that math, you're like, Chris, you know what? What if all the countries of the world suddenly made this their number one priority? Hey, maybe we could still have a shot at this, right? All right, that brings us to complicating factor number two, humans and their behavior. Human behavior. Oh, let's look into this. Okay. One reason that an easy, seamless transition to alternative energy won't happen is because our biological human wiring, it's really terrible at responding to such big, complex, long-range predicaments. You know, a snarling saber-toothed tiger crouching right in front of us? Hey, that we know how to respond to. We're really good at that. Filling our bellies from a ripe tree, fruit tree to sate our hunger? Hey, we are absolutely wired for solving that problem. But organizing ourselves against a faceless, distant threat, that's just not in our wiring. Even worse, if the threat's the... God, if the face of the threat's actually the one that stares at us in the mirror, that works against our wiring. And trying to convince people to make sacrifices today for no immediate or visible reward? God, that's really not at all in our biological wheelhouse. So, when united towards a common goal, humans can do amazing things. I mean, history's full of this. We've seen it. Simply brilliant and astonishing works exist that inform us of what's possible when we set our collective minds to a shared mission, right? We've got the Great Pyramids, towering Middle Age cathedrals like that Flying Buttress Cathedral at Chartres in France, the Great Wall of China, the Apollo missions. But far less is possible when we're fractured and divided. And that's where we are right now. We're currently in the United States having trouble trying to agree on which genders should use a particular bathroom. We're having trouble being civil when we're standing in line for a heavily discounted TV. You know, it's just we're not in the best mind to really operate in a true collective organized fashion. So given this, you know, it's just impossible to imagine the increasingly divided populations in the UK, in France, America, or Germany agreeing on much of anything at this point, let alone a gigantic and massively expensive energy transition. Each country I just listed is currently struggling with its own brew of domestic, social, and political problems. You know, all of them of their own making, I should add. But it means that they, all of us, all those countries, they have neither the ability nor the appetite to take on the much more challenging task of a 30-year global energy infrastructure rebuild. Making this energy transition is going to require enormous, enormous diversions of effort away from this and towards that. And it's going to be hard, right? It's going to take a lot of political capital and expert leadership. Huge pain and suffering will result as entire industries are shut down, right? New ones are going to start up, of course, but oh, think of the challenges to shutting down industries. Oh my gosh. Just drive through any former mill or mining region and you can see the bitter remnants of its abandoned industries. Right? Some have not yet recovered, even hundreds of years after the initial loss. When the coal mines died out, so did the cities. You know, if you've ever driven through an old coal mining town where this mine has gone defunct in West Virginia, in Pennsylvania, you'll see this. Or here in my own state, you see what happens when the mills left, right? In Lowell, Mass., all these mills powered by the waterworks there. And when those industries left, the buildings remain rotting away, but the vitality of the city never quite came back, you know, or it's taken a very, very long time. With an energy transition away from fossil fuels, there are going to be new and similar examples of ruined economic ideas littering the land. You know, places where refineries now stand with their thousands of jobs will become rusting derelicts. Ditto for hundreds of other dependent businesses, ranging from Jiffy Lube to Boeing, gas stations, airports, you name it, right? Which brings us now to the complicating factor number three, time, scale, and cost. Now, suppose for a moment, just for a moment, that we did decide, you know what, this is it. And we began building three nuclear power plants every 2 days in earnest. Like we really just like that's what we started doing. First, how much is that going to cost, right? Who's going to pay for that exactly? Second, are there enough skilled workers in manufacturing facilities even to make and install all of the components, right? And third, even after these nuclear plants are all up and running, is there even enough uranium in the world to fuel the eventual 16,500 new additional plants that we would be building according to this three every 2 days model? And the answer to each of those questions, you know, first, second, third, the answer to each of those is some form of, nah, it's not really possible. So let's look at the third case to sort of illustrate this, right? The entire amount of all known uranium reserves in the world are only currently sufficient to supply the existing approximately 400 reactors in the world for 90 years. Now, if we expanded the number of reactors by a factor of 41, right, that's 16,500 divided by 400. So we expand the number of reactors by 41, that 90 years of supply of uranium shrinks to just a little over 2 years. You know, let's be generous and say we find 100% more uranium than we thought. Make that 4 years, right? Nobody's going to build a nuclear plant with just 2 or even 4 years of uranium around to supply it. Now, that said, I'm a huge fan, researching the use and installation of thorium reactors. I've explored this before with podcast guest Kurt Sorensen. I think there's some real hope there, but we haven't started. Like, there's no money going to that. You know, the United States doesn't even have an exploration program for thorium, as far as I understand. But, you know, leaving that aside, point three is, we look at the scale of this thing. We just don't have enough uranium to even run that model. But guess what? Similar supply constraints arise if we calculate out the amount of resources required to build the amount of wind towers. Like, is there even enough square miles of suitable wind territory to put towers up, right? You run out of the space to put these things sometimes, but there's critical minerals and components to go into the making of the magnets in the case of wind towers, or there's certain types of solderings that go into the solar panels, or other trace minerals and critical rare things, right? So, and also complicating this, there just aren't enough hydro dam sites to even begin to make a dent. Most of the world's best hydro sites are already dammed. There might be a few more, but there's just, if we went on a damming spree, I think hydropower is fantastic, but it's limited by geography, really. And rainfall, of course. Also complicating this whole story is that each of these so-called alternative energy systems themselves requires a huge amount of fossil fuels to mine the components, to manufacture the components, to install them, maintain them, all of that. The world has yet to see even a single example of a single windmill or a single solar panel that was mined, manufactured, installed, all on the basis of using the energy that only came from alternative energy. Fossil energy is embedded in every step of our process. It's an enormously complex problem. So I want to talk about the vision we need here. You know, the answer to the post-fossil fuel era is not an alt energy system capable of providing us with exactly the same things in the same way of life, right? Because it's just not feasible. I'm going to say it's impossible based on the math that we just ran. The answer, of course, lies in doing more with less. You know, right now in the United States, I'm sad to say that the top three best-selling vehicles all happen to be some version of an SUV or a light truck, right? It's the Ford F-150, the Chevy Tahoe, stuff like that, right? And it's so prevalent that U.S. citizens are buying these two-ton vehicles to sort of scoot around town in, that even Ford announced that they're going to drop making sedans. Like, nobody's buying cars, those tiny things, those little things that just move humans and a few things around. People are buying really big things. And so that's not an example of doing more with less. That's the opposite of that. That's doing less with more, right? So we got to switch that. But guess what? We already know how to build smaller cars, and we know how to build electric vehicles. We know how to build structures that will last for hundreds of years, right? They're not disposable. Oh, you know, the whole high school's fallen down. You know, it was built in 1963. We got to just it's a wreck. We have to replace it, right? We got to get rid of that disposable mentality. And we can also build buildings in a way which require almost no energy to operate for heating and cooling, right? But those are still really very rarely built today because they cost more. You know, we already know how to build small light vehicles and operate mass transit very energy efficiently. But society, as I said, it prefers really huge cars and trucks because they're still affordable, you know, while debt is cheap. And they're convenient, of course. We already know how to grow more food closer to home that's far healthier for humans and the ecosystem alike, but it's still actually pretty much only done on a boutique basis because it costs a little bit more. This is why people need to be told the truth and inspired with a vision that we can all share. You know, with a grand cause, anything is possible. Without one, nothing's gonna get done. So the vision we need will align what needs to be done with proper incentives to get those things done. We'll be told the truth, what's expected, and our role in the project. It will imbue many lives with a sense of meaning and purpose that are currently nearly or entirely missing in the lives of most people. However, you know, given the enormity of the challenge and the fractured, divisive social and political landscape that we're currently in the middle of, you really need to plan for nothing happening, right? No vision, no saviors. That vision's not coming along. It's just, you know, we're pretty much on our own here. And I think the best prediction you can make here is that we, the collective we're just going to merrily continue along this path until we run out of path, we run out of time, and we even run out of the energy resources necessary to build that brilliant future, you know? And I guess all we'll have the time and energy left to do out there in the future is we'll regret our mistakes. We'll regret not having made different decisions a few decades ago. So the odds are we're going to keep heading straight along our current trajectory until, you know, clunk, right over the edge. My conclusion here is that given the math, human tendencies, the issues pertaining to time, scale, cost, the current green energy movement is currently it's a little more than hot air at this point. You know, it's just not going to happen in time or even at scale, right? We're nowhere close to being able to build out the massive energy projects required. The equivalent of 3 nuclear plants every 2 days for the next 30 years, that's a pipe dream. Not going to happen. We lack the political will, the cultural readiness, the proper narrative, even the necessary resources, right? Beyond those concerns, nearly everything about how we heat, move, cool, and manufacture the components of our modern lives is going to have to be refashioned and possibly jettisoned as part of that project. Such an ambitious undertaking, it has no historical analog. It's a ridiculously complex set of problems, which have solutions, and predicaments, which don't have any solutions. They just have managed outcomes. It's both those things. And it's exactly the sort of situation that politicians will avoid as long as possible, after which it will be too late to do really very much about it at all. Which means you need to adjust your expectations and investment of your money and energy accordingly, right? Adjust your expectations and investment of your money and energy. Put those in the right areas right now. The entire world, which is utterly dependent on infinite growth, is only years away from grasping the impossibility of that approach. And when it does, everything's going to change really quickly. I'm seeing more and more of this pop up. 5 years ago, that was a very lonely thing to say. Infinite growth is impossible, right? I'm seeing it more and more. It'll grow, and all of a sudden, it's going to snap into public consciousness because that's how these things tend to work. And when it does, things are going to change very quickly when that happens. And in this story, boy, I'd much rather be a year early than a day late, right? This is also why myself personally, Peak Prosperity as an organization, spend so much time and effort alerting people to these particular realities and then helping them make and take informed actions that align with the future that we all see, or maybe we feel, coming. All right, that's the end of part one. In part two, Reality Shock, we examine the most compelling evidence I know of for why taking matters into your own hands is really just so important to do right now. It explains everything from slowing global economic growth, which is happening right now, to the widening wealth gap, hey, been a story for a while, to the rising rejection of globalization, yep, and the increasingly desperate mad dash at any cost for what remains of natural resources. Humanity is really very much in the early innings of a great transition, and losing access to abundant energy will change things more than you or I can appreciate at this time. The future is barreling towards us at a furious and accelerating pace. Please get prepared. Thank you for listening.